listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com, on Facebook, on Twitter, at Jackie Daily Host, and subscribe for free at your favorite podcasting outlet, The Blaze, iHeartRadio, and others. All right, this show, I am very excited because I think I have a new friend in Rick Rule. Rick Rule, he is the founder of Global Resource Investments and Sprott Asset Management. He is one of the most sought after financial advisors in the United States, with like decades of experience telling you how to stay alive financially. His contacts and knowledge of the market are unmatched. And I went to him because a friend of mine who is a day trader said, this is the guy you want to ask, how do I stay alive financially in times of war and volatility? How do I protect myself? Is it about gold, silver, other commodities? Is it too late to get in? Because, you know, we should have foreseen the instability coming on right now based on our leadership here at home, which is probably perceived as weak around the world, and therefore bad actors act. And so Rick has a lot of advice that is entertaining and riveting as to what you can and should be doing right now. And I just really appreciated so many of his insights. I mean, I was actually taking copious notes, something I rarely do during interviews. But he refers to quantitative easing as counterfeiting. If you and I did it, it's counterfeiting. If a congressman does it, it's quantitative easing. And basically throwing out money to buy votes with other people's cash. And then he describes debt as a wealth transfer. This is U.S. government debt. This is wealth transfer from the young and the productive to those who are past their prime. And he says that's like himself because he's a little more advanced in age than me. But in fact, he's still producing and still giving great advice. So much to say. And you will not want to miss that, because if you have any ability at all to prepare yourself financially for what's about to come, you want to hear from him. Then I speak with Alma Cook. Alma Cook, she has a safety compliance firm up in the Bakken oil field in North Dakota, but she is a musical artist who has written an ode to the oil patch. She has a new song, a new single called 5,000 Candles, 5,000 Candles. And it's all about how she left the big city and moved to the Bakken to take a job in compliance, and actually fell in love with the place and with the people. And she's written a song and made a music video about it that you can certainly check out. She is at HearAlma.com. That's H-E-A-R, HearAlma, A-L-M-A.com. And I will play that song for you later in the show. Then I speak with my friend Doug Sandridge. And Doug is a senior VP at Fulcrum Energy. He heard Michael Bloomberg say, you know, if only you'll vote for me for president, I will transition the United States to 80% renewables by the year 2028. That was such a false and impossible and outrageous statement that Doug Sandridge was motivated to create a 100-page, beautiful, colorful, illustrated PowerPoint presentation that he gives at petroleum clubs, laying out these seven obstacles, and there are many others, but just the top seven, to net zero emissions. And why, if you hear someone like Bloomberg talk like that, you can know he's just not telling you the truth, because Bloomberg is a very intelligent man, and he should know better. So there's that. But first, let me share with you something a little different. I was reading for the show, and I ran across a piece by my friend Hans von Spakovsky over at the Heritage Foundation. And it's titled, Ode to Patrick Henry. We're still fighting to protect our liberty today. And it was so touching. And when I read the founders and what they were going through, I feel like someone understands. You know, what it's like to be alive in 2022 and have all the institutions and the powers that be coming against you, and watching a book of, or at least a chapter of the book of Revelation unfold on a semi-regular basis. Well, so Hans describes it this way: Americans fighting the attempts to restrict our liberties, destroy our culture, and manipulate our society using the imperious power of government, sometimes may forget we've been struggling to preserve our liberty and freedoms since the beginning of our nation. And he and his wife went to St. John's Church building, which is actually still an operational functioning church today. It was around 250 years ago, and that is where Patrick Henry gave his "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. By the way, we have a liberty or death flag right here in the studio. I love it. I love it. Do you know, American soldiers of the Revolutionary War marched into battle carrying liberty or death flags. That's so awesome. So awesome. So, and why? The Stamp Act, the Sugar Act, the Townsend Acts, the Intolerable Acts. People, these are things like taxes on stamps and sugar. Okay? That was enough for them to say, you know what? It's not about the money. It's about the principle. We are self-governing people, and we're not going to tolerate. We will not tolerate these people on the other side of the ocean not giving us representation and doing this to us. It's ridiculous. In addition to a long line and litany of offenses that you will find delineated in your Declaration of Independence, there's much more. Well, here's what happened. They all come together, and it was many of the founders. And Patrick Henry says, should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense? I should consider myself guilty of treason toward my country and of an act of disloyalty toward the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be next week or the next? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and when a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we gather strength by irresolution and inaction? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope? Sir, we are not weak if we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature hath placed in our power. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. I tear up. That is so awesome. I'll bet he was hot. Any man that talks like that? That's what's now called mojo. He had some cojones. That's awesome. Seriously, I just broke out in a sweat. That was awesome. We need more Founding Fathers readings. I can't read them without getting choked up. Are you inspired? So Hans von Spakovsky wrote that he went to, literally, to St. John's Church to hear this reenactment of the debates between the founders. I would have loved that. And that it really gave him brand new energy to mount the fight. That is awesome. I love it. Again, check it out. This is by Hans von Spakovsky, Ode to Patrick Henry. We're still fighting to protect our liberty today. I believe I must transition to the break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com. And from there, you can go to my Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc., and subscribe for free on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, Blaze, elsewhere. All right, so I find that I never stop explaining to people why net zero emissions is impossible. It is impossible. Impossible. Not hard. not long term. It is impossible, at least with the technology available to mankind right now. And so I met a friend in Colorado at the Steamboat Institute event. His name is Doug Sandridge. He's the senior VP over at Fulcrum Energy Capital Funds. And he actually, it turns out, has a presentation, long form. Like, this is like a Joe Rogan thing. Now, this is Jackie Daly show, so it'll be like 20 minutes, but maybe 30. But he has seven obstacles to net zero carbon emissions. He actually has taken the time to create like a 100-page PowerPoint that he presents, at least in one instance, at the Denver Petroleum Club. And wow, it is like the most beautiful, colorful, graph-laden, riveting example and exhibit to explain this. And so I asked Doug Sandridge, would you please come on the show and share with us what are the seven obstacles for people who want to learn these and share them and pull them out at cocktail parties to have to knock down those Michael Bloomberg enthusiasts who say, well, no, Doug, I voted for Michael Bloomberg. He's a very smart man. And he said that we can get to 80% renewables by 2028. If only we would have voted for him, we would have saved the planet. All right, Doug, tackle it. Why is that not true?
Okay. Well, let's first start by an understanding what we mean by net zero carbon emissions. In the general sense, when we say net zero carbon emissions, what we really mean is total human-caused carbon, CO2 emissions, equals zero. We're not talking about zero carbon emissions, period, because most carbon emissions are naturally occurring. What people are seemingly concerned about is the excess carbon emissions created by humans. And another way to reach net zero carbon emissions would be total carbon emissions less CO2 emissions that were removed, so i.e. carbon capture. But we don't really have any viable, affordable, scalable carbon capture technologies right now. So for all practical purposes, when we talk about net zero carbon emissions, we're talking about eliminating all human-made carbon CO2. So that's a pretty large problem to tackle. And I think a lot of people don't even fully understand what that means. Now, Bill Gates recently, as you know, wrote a book called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And I was not overly impressed by his second half of his book when he described to us what the problems are, I mean, how we're going to solve the problems. But he did a quite good job of explaining what the problems are. And I'm just pulling from his folksy explanation. He said about 27% of our carbon emissions are things like electric lights, computers, things we plug in. 16% is getting around, cars, trucks, planes, cargo, ships, et cetera. And another 7% is heating, air conditioning, and refrigeration. Well, if you add that up, that's only 50%. Most people don't think about the other 50% being 19% things we grow, beef, cattle, and things that we make like cement, steel, and plastic. So when you're talking about net zero carbon emissions, it means that you're eliminating all carbon emissions from all of those, from plugging in, getting around, keeping warm, making things, and growing things. And you're not talking about just doing it in Dallas, Texas, or just in Texas, or even in the U.S. It's got to be everywhere. I mean, it's got to be net zero carbon emissions throughout, because we've historically been very good about exporting our carbon emissions. California invented that. They invented, oh, we're not going to do cement. We're not going to have allow cement plants in California anymore, but instead they just import their cement from Tijuana. We're going to get rid of all of our...
So much more environmentally friendly in Tijuana. They have much higher standards there.
And we're going to get rid of all our coal plants, but you're still going to import electricity generated from coal from Wyoming and Utah and Arizona. So, you know, it doesn't do any good to get rid of net zero carbon emissions just in your backyard. I mean, if you're serious about net zero, that means net zero everywhere, all the time. So that's a much bigger problem. And I don't think when people even just think about the idea of how you're going to net zero all of those things, people really understand what that means. I mean, in terms of getting around, that means you got to get rid of all internal combustion engines, not just in rich San Francisco or in Boulder, Colorado. You got to get rid of all cars, trucks, airplanes, ships, trains, tractors, bulldozers, lawnmowers, snowblowers here and in Shanghai and in the Congo. So, you know, it's the scope of it. I mean, the average person does not understand the scope of the energy business and how incredibly immense an effort it would be to get rid of all those internal combustion engines and all the other things you would need to do to get to net zero. So in response to Michael Bloomberg's proclamation, I identified what I call the seven primary hurdles to reaching net zero carbon emissions. That didn't mean there's not more dilemmas, but those are the seven primary dilemmas. And I'll just tell you what they are real quickly. The first one is called the supply chain dilemma. Second one is the energy transition minerals dilemma, intermittency dilemma, power density dilemma, grid balancing dilemma, the transmission dilemma, and finally, the local distribution dilemma. And unless you can solve all seven of those dilemmas, then you're never going to get to net zero. And frankly, I'm not sure we can solve any of those dilemmas in any meaningful way, you know, in the next 30 to 50 years.
So, well, let me stop you for just a second. Sure. I saw an article by Mark Mills that was amazing. And he makes this argument, hey, you know what? We don't even have enough of one of the rare earth elements required to create enough batteries to transition the U.S. transportation sector from internal combustion engines to electric cars. Now, even if we did, they'd still be coal-powered vehicles. But
yeah, of course.
But let's pretend that somehow an electric vehicle is not a fossil fuel-powered vehicle for a second and suspend all belief. Well, or disbelief. He's saying we don't have enough lithium on Earth. We don't have enough cobalt on Earth. We don't have enough of anything on Earth just to transition the U.S. transportation sector, much less the entire planet. Now, I'm doing this from memory. I don't have that in front of me right now. But that's how I remember it. Is that what you mean?
Yes. That is definitely, you know, that is my number two dilemma, energy transition minerals dilemma. And I kind of define that as the energy transition minerals, I should say, are a variety of minerals that are needed for electric vehicle batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, and other renewable and so-called clean energy-related technologies. So I like to quote other reputable organizations instead of my own research because, you know, they have more credibility. Nobody knows who Doug Sandridge is, but everybody knows who the International Energy Agency is. And the International Energy Agency used to be a very reputable down-the-middle organization that just provided good data on energy. They've become very politicized in the last few years. And they become very politicized and anti-fossil fuel and very pro-renewable. So they've lost some of their luster because they do have a clear political agenda now, whereas in the past they have not. And in fact, recently, if you recall, they recently proclaimed that we should stop immediately investing in all forms of fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, and petroleum. They said that just a few months ago, that we should do that immediately and not, you know, 10 years from now or 15 years from now. So that gives you an idea who that organization is. And so last year, that organization came out with a remarkable study about vital or energy transition minerals. And so I do have a little of that data here in front of me. They, according to the International Energy Agency, this is in 2021, and understand they're very pro-renewable, but they state that a staggering quantities of energy transition minerals will be required by 2040 in order to attain net zero carbon emissions. They said rare earth mineral production in the next 20 years would have to not double, not triple, but increase by 700%. Nickel would have to increase by 1,900%. Graphite, 2,500%, cobalt, 3,000%, and lithium, 4,200%. Well, I'm not sure that we have the ability to mine that amount of any of those products, much less all of them, on that scale in such a short period of time. Because, you know, it takes a long time to get mining operations going, and we don't have much of that going on in the U.S.
No.
So is that kind of the figures you recall?
Yes, exactly. That's it. You're definitely ringing those bells. Now, I have to cut to break, but when we come back, I'm going to have Doug Sandridge continue and go down the line of his seven obstacles to net zero carbon emissions. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Doug Sandridge. He is a senior VP at Fulcrum Energy Capital Funds, and he has a 100-page presentation called Seven Obstacles to Net Zero Carbon Emissions. And he explains why when someone like Michael Bloomberg, smart as he is, makes a claim that if only you'll elect him, he will transition the U.S. to 80% renewable energy by 2028. You can know that that statement is categorically false because it is not possible given the obstacles in front of us right now. We cannot do net zero right now. I don't know what humankind can invent 5 years from now. They could change the game. We're talking about right now. So we covered in the last segment the problem of not having enough minerals like lithium and cobalt, the things that make up electric car vehicles, solar panels, wind turbines. They're literally is nowhere near enough of that being mined anywhere on Earth to even begin to dream of the promises made. So having covered, that's number two out of seven. Doug, you've got 12 minutes, no, 10. And we can actually do a third segment if you have the time.
Sure.
But can you walk us through the other six?
Well, I'm gonna just mention a couple other quick things about the energy transition minerals dilemma, because it's not just that it's very difficult to mine them and that we just don't simply have enough of them and we don't have enough mines, but it's also most of those products have to be processed. And what China has done is they have played the whole West as fools for the last 20 years because they have taken over all of the processing of those products. And so they control the entire supply chain of most of those products. So if you look like at a product like cobalt, even though most of the cobalt is made in the Congo, is mined in the Congo, two-thirds of the world's cobalt is processed in China. So they are going to control the supply chain for cobalt, even if they don't mine it. The same thing for rare earth minerals. China currently processes close to 90% of the rare earth minerals. And so they have really put us in a bad position because if we want them, we have to get the rare earth minerals from China, and that weakens our political position as well. And so the final thing I'll say about the energy dilemma number two is we hear about this so-called energy transition, which is, I think, often characterized as a transition from fossil fuels to renewables. But in reality, it's a transition from fossil fuels to minerals and metals. That's how we need to look at it.
That's a great way to say it. From fossil fuels to minerals and metals. Which,
exactly.
I mean, fossil fuels, we call them minerals, too.
Yeah,
so explain
true.
That. I mean, that's less common.
In the context that most people think of minerals being the cobalt and the lithium and other things. And I'll make one other point, which I think, again, I'm going to quote someone else. But last year, the U.S. Department of Energy, this puts things in context. They put out a chart. It's one of the charts that is in this presentation. But they put out a chart that says this is how many tons of material is required to make a terawatt of energy. So a terawatt of energy being 1,000 gigawatts of energy. And if you look at coal, natural gas, and nuclear, it takes about 1,000 tons approximately of, as some people call it, stuff to make a power plant to make that. So to make a coal power plant or a nuclear power plant or to mine natural gas and burn it in a power plant, you need concrete, steel, glass, rare earth minerals, all those sorts of things. So coal, natural gas, and nuclear require about 1,000 tons of material to make 1 terawatt of energy. Solar panels require 16 times as much concrete, steel, glass, rare earth minerals. Wind requires 10 times as much. So every time you replace a nuclear plant or a natural gas plant with a wind farm that makes the equivalent amount of energy or a solar farm that makes the equivalent amount of energy, you're using 16,000 tons of material versus 1 ton for nuclear, coal, and natural gas. And I think that's something that unless you understand that and see it in a chart, it's just almost hard to fathom.
Yeah, well, and it just feels, and maybe I'm not a material scientist, but it just feels like the more space you need, the more activity you need, the more movement you need, the more materials you need, the less green, as a general rule, right? So, I mean, I hear my friends who create natural gas saying, do you realize the amount of space required for a natural gas well versus a solar field versus a wind farm? I mean, the amount of property alone.
Do you want to just transition? You've done the segue. You've done it for me. So let's transition to energy dilemma number 4, which is what I call the power density dilemma. And, you know, basically, as you said, crude oil, natural gas, coal, and nuclear power provide dense power potential utilizing a relatively small amount of land, whereas wind and solar require much larger areas of land for the equivalent amount of power. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, but I don't think most people recognize what that really means in terms of scale and scope. So I'm going to turn to our mutual friend, Robert Bryce, mm-hmm. who has done a lot of lecturing on this, and I'm using his data. But if you're familiar with the Indian Point Power Plant in New York that was closed down exactly a year ago.
Yep.
And, of course, it was a tragedy in my view that we closed down a perfectly good cathedral of clean energy making no CO2. And that Indian Point Power Plant produced about 16.4 terawatt hours of energy per year. Now, if you look at a picture of that plant, you will see the nuclear containment, the nuclear reactor in a containment. You'll see the cafeteria where the employees eat. You'll see a parking lot. You'll see where the fuel is stored. You'll see where the waste fuel is stored. I mean, the whole entire plant, everything, including parking spaces, takes an area of about 250 acres. So if you were to make the same amount of energy using wind turbines, instead of it taking 250 acres, it would take over 1,000 times as many acres. It'd take 330,000 acres on average in the U.S. Instead of covering less than 0.5 square mile, it's going to cover about 500 or 550 square miles of land. So this is exactly what you were speaking to, power density. And, you know, we have wind farms all over dotting Texas and Oklahoma and Colorado and Wyoming, but you know, these are just one-offs, and we have nearly 10,000 power plants in the U.S. So I think we have about 9,700 power plants in the U.S. So can you imagine how much area it would take in the U.S. if you were to replace all 9,700 of our conventional power plants with wind turbines? I mean, it would cover the whole country.
Like, literally, we're talking about state after state after state after state would just be one solid field.
Yeah, so don't take my word for it. Let me give you an example of that. I don't know if you're familiar with the prominent professor Vaclav Smil. He's a distinguished professor of environmental science at Manitoba University. Do you know him?
I do not.
He is considered probably the world's foremost authority on power density. He wrote a book recently called Power Density that most geeks like me have read. And he recently did a study where he tried to figure out how much of the U.S. landmass would have to be covered if we were to have an entirely renewable system. And I'm quoting here in his book, an entirely renewable energy system would occupy 25 to 50% of the United States area, compared to less than 0.5% of land claimed by fossil fuels, hydro, and nuclear currently. So he's saying, just at this is his quote, not mine, that we would have to cover 25 to 50% of the U.S. Now, that sounds pretty horrible to me, but it's worse than that, because when you say that, you don't even realize, 16% of the U.S. is, I think, Alaska is 16% of the landmass. Well, you're not going to put anything up there because you don't have any way to get the electricity down to the mainland. You're not going to put it in National Forest. You're not going to put it in Yosemite National Park or in Yellowstone. You're not going to be able to put it on tops of the Rocky Mountains or in the marshes of Louisiana. So when you take away all of those obvious places that you're not going to put it, then you're talking about putting it at about 75 to 100% of the remainder of the United States would have to be covered by renewable energy if you wanted to do just renewables alone.
Wow.
Does that sound 75.
Feasible? Yeah, I mean, that's powerful, because you're exactly right. We could spend hours marking off all of the places where you would not put wind or solar because it's just not either feasible or wise.
Or desirable.
Or desirable. Like, at least I'm looking at your graph of Colorado, and I saw you're putting the pattern of solar generation. Well, okay, at least Colorado is a high altitude state that gets a ton of sunshine.
Exactly.
And so you're up high, so you're getting some intensity there. You're closer to the sun than we are here in Texas. So perhaps you get more electrons off of a panel there, and it makes at least more sense. Or maybe in Death Valley, you get great sun. But how about, the mountains of West Virginia? What are we going to do? Are we going to deforest?
Yeah, of course.
Are we going to deforest West Virginia?
Well, that's what they're doing, and that's what they're doing a lot of that in Europe right now. I mean, they are actually cutting down old-growth forests to put up more wind turbines in Germany. It's just disgraceful.
Well, and here's the crazy part, too. The German thing really bothers me. That whole country and its history. And he's still looking at me saying, you got to go to break. So I will just make this point before we get a break. They have some of the smartest people in the left brain anywhere in the world. German engineering is legendary. Yet they seem to have the worst right brain. They cannot connect these disparate parts. If it's not linear, if it's not an equation, they will make the wrong turn every time in policy and in governance. Really, one of the worst countries on earth for policy. It's not that they're bad people. They're missing their right brain. It's atrophied or something. I don't know. And I'm, I have some German blood, so I'm just talking about myself too. But okay, that's crazy talk. Horrible energy policy. One of the worst. All right, cutting to break. When I come back, with Doug Sandridge, he is the senior VP at Fulcrum Energy. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Doug Sandridge. He is the senior VP over at Fulcrum Energy Capital Funds. I met him in Colorado at the Steamboat Institute conference, which was just fantastic. You've heard me talk about that. And he told me that he has a presentation that he gave at the Denver Petroleum Club. It's called 7 Obstacles to Net Zero Carbon Emissions. And he was inspired to create this because of Michael Bloomberg's absurd promise that if only you would make him president, he could convert the U.S. to being 80% renewable by the year 2028. Well, Doug Sandridge put down at least 7 reasons, but there are others. 7 big reasons why that cannot possibly be true or real. So, Doug, we've covered the transition minerals problem, literally. We don't have enough lithium, cobalt, whatever, to create the batteries, the wind turbines, the solar panels, not even too close. We covered power density. You'd have to cover 75 to 100% of the U.S. that isn't off limits with solar farms to even begin to get serious about a promise like this. Did we hit the supply chain obstacles?
No, we'll go back to that, but I want to make one more plug on that power density, because again, I want to use other credible sources. Don't take my words for it. That book that I quoted from Václav Smil. On the cover of his book, he got an endorsement from Bill Gates. And Bill Gates said, Smil is one of my favorite authors. The term polymath was made for people like him. I learned more by reading Václav Smil than just about anyone else. So when Bill Gates says the smartest guy in the room is Václav Smil, you know, that's pretty credible.
Okay.
So we can talk about that, but you made an interesting comment about the price about Germany's policy. And I actually have an interesting comparison here that you might be interested in, because one thing that drives me crazy is I'm not trying to set policy here. I'm trying to educate the public as to what's possible so that we can make better policy decisions.
Right.
So I'm not saying that we shouldn't do these things. I'm not saying we shouldn't do renewables. I'm just saying I think that we need to evaluate them honestly and fairly. And one of the things that drives me crazy is these people who continue to say that renewables are cheaper than conventional power. Now, it's just nonsense when you look at it honestly. Now, true, there are some circumstances when the marginal cost of creating one additional kilowatt from wind might be cheaper than natural gas, but not in a system, because that marginal price does not take into account the unreliability and intermittency. And if you take into account the backup power required of renewables and the intermittency aspects, then the price of renewables is not as cheap as conventional energy. I'm not saying that it's not worth it. I'm not saying that we shouldn't use renewables. I just object to the misrepresentation, because they try and sell people on the idea we should do renewables because it's cheaper. It's not cheaper. So let me give you an example of this. Germany is the perfect example to look at. And so I've looked back at the last 20 years in German power, and in the last 20 years, Germany has about doubled its power capacity. So what they have done is they built massive amounts of wind and solar, but unlike California, they were smart enough to keep all of their conventional power. So what they have done is they have gone from 109 gigawatts of energy capability, power capability 20 years ago, to more than doubling it to 220 gigawatts. So they've doubled the amount primarily by building massive amounts of wind and solar. But during that same period of time, German power consumption has not increased. In fact, it's actually decreased over that period of time. So what has happened is they have really committed to renewables, but the reality is they've done so while maintaining a completely duplicate backup traditional energy system. And so when you look at the price in the U.S., our average cost of electricity in the U.S. is about 13 cents a kilowatt hour across the U.S. And in Germany, before this winter's energy crisis. This is before that. Their price was fully three times as much as the U.S. Their average cost was almost 40 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm. And that's because they run a very costly renewable system, and they also maintain a backup system, which they use when the renewables don't work, which is what they're doing right now, burning a lot of coal and a lot of natural gas and blah, blah, blah.
Well, so let me stop you for a second, because I had heard that the Germany was closing down some of its conventional production. Now, maybe what you're saying is they're not just decommissioning it and breaking it down, because, you know, that would sure help you pivot, even though you can't start mining on a dime coal, or you can't just snap your finger and boom, the gas plant's going again. But at least you wouldn't be at the mercy of the Russians as much as the Baltic states, and the neighbors to the east, at least.
Yeah, Germany has shut down some of its conventional electricity power generation, but most of that has been nuclear, which, of course, is a whole other argument. We'll do another podcast next week on that, because that's another crisis. But they've kept most of their coal and all of their natural gas, and so they essentially operate duplicate systems. They operate a renewable system, and they operate a system that backs up the renewables, and they pay the cost of maintaining that system and supplying that system, and they're doing that right now. So at least they're intellectually honest enough to realize that they need a backup system. California is insane because they have shut down most of their a lot of their conventional power, but they really did it without a real good plan of what was going to replace it. So, you know, they got rid of all their coal power plants. They got rid of all their nuclear power plants except Diablo Canyon, which, of course, is scheduled to shut down, in, I believe, in 2 years. Many of their natural gas plants have shut down because they simply can't make money because the rules are like they are in a lot of states. They don't allow the natural gas plants to work unless it's a last resort. They use wind and solar, and then the gas plants only are there as backup. And so a lot of them have gone out of business because they just can't make enough money just being on standby all the time. They haven't built a new wind farm in California, I believe, in 7 years because environmentalists have fought it. And so in reality, they shut down all this conventional energy, and they don't even have a real viable solution, and that's why they have so many brownouts and blackouts, and that's one reason why a lot of companies are moving out of California, because if you're a business, you got to have reliable electricity.
Oh, yeah.
And so here's their state, California. They have the most unreliable energy system, electricity system in the country, and their cost is more than twice the national average. So that's another faulty way of going.
Okay.
So, sorry, I jumped ahead there, but let's just jump back up to you wanted to talk about the supply chain dilemma. So supply chain dilemma, here's my deal is you really, like we said before, you don't really create net zero carbon emissions unless you create zero carbon emissions at every level. I mean, if we export the production of a product somewhere else and then we import that product, we are essentially importing the CO2 emissions that were created somewhere else. So in order to eliminate, this is supply chain dilemma number one, in order to eliminate carbon emissions, you have to eliminate them at every level of the supply chain. So that means you've got trucks and bulldozers, loaders and graders in the Congo or in Peru, you know, mining lithium or cobalt. Well, all of those trucks and bulldozers and loaders and graders, they're all operating on diesel.
Yeah.
So if you're going net zero, those have to go from diesel to what? Renewable bulldozers and renewable trucks, or I mean what? So the mining and the raw mineral extraction has to be changed so it's net zero. It's not just net zero when the wind turbine is installed. It has to be net zero at the raw material extraction point. Then those raw materials are transferred by trucks and trains and ships, usually to China. And usually those trucks and trains and ships are using bunker fuel or diesel fuel. And then when they get to China, they're going by truck and train to the manufacturing plants where they're using 70% coal in China. And almost 100% of their manufacturing is either coal or natural gas. So all of that has to be switched to renewable manufacturing. And then once it's manufactured, it has to go on a truck and then a train and then a ship to Houston Ship Channel and offloaded there onto trucks and trains that take it to Wyoming. And then you use trucks and cranes that are diesel-powered to install the wind turbines. And then you've got trucks and trains and cranes for the next 20 years that are maintaining and disposing of those wind farms. So until you clean up all that supply chain, you haven't done anything except shift the carbon emissions. You haven't eliminated them. You just shifted them to somewhere else. So the supply chain dilemma is how do you clean up every single stage in the life cycle of, you know, a product like that?
Okay. Okay, so I've got 1 minute left. Pick your factor. How many have we gone through now? One, two, four.
We've gone through three. Well, I mean, obviously the intermittency factor of wind and solar is a problem because you really can't depend on them to deliver power when you need it. So that means you either have to back it up with batteries, which we don't have scalable, affordable, utility-scale batteries at this point, or you have to back it up with natural gases, which is what most of us do right now. You've got to find a way to do all this while still trying to balance the grid. You're going to have to build massive amounts of transmission. I have seen studies recently by credible organizations, for instance, Princeton University, are saying the transmission that would be required to go to 100% renewables, you'd have to go between 3 and 5 times our current transmission to that level, you'd have to expand our current transmission by a factor of 3 to 5 times in order to deliver the renewables from the remote places where they'd be generated, Wyoming or North Dakota or wherever, to the places like LA or Dallas or Miami where it's needed. So transmission is a huge dilemma, and there's no way we're going to even double our transmission system, much less multiply it by a factor of 3 or 5 times. And then the last one, which is most people don't think about, it's very simple, is local distribution. Once you get the electricity to the local distribution hubs, like your town, like Dallas, well, Dallas is going to have to go in and upgrade every substation, all their wiring, all their transformers in every neighborhood are going to have to be replaced with bigger transformers, because once you add 3 to 5 electric vehicles at every single household when nobody drives combustion engines anymore, well, the system isn't made for that. So we're going to have to remake all of our local distribution systems, and we're not doing any of that now. And it would probably take 20 to 30 to 40 years to do it if you started today and had an unlimited budget and unlimited, employees to do that. So it's far off fantasy.
We're talking with Doug Sandridge, and he is the Senior VP over at Fulcrum Energy Capital Funds. Doug, that was amazing. That was like drinking from a fire hose, but very, very, very good stuff. Thank you so much for all the work you've done. And yes, I will have you back if you'd like to talk about nuclear, if you're interested.
Sure. Let's stay in touch. We got lots to talk about.
All right. Perfect.
Thanks, Jackie.
You're welcome. It's great to talk with you. I'm going to take a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online, jackiedaily.com. That's Jackie, no E, daily like every day. And subscribe for free at most any quality podcasting outlet. All right, true story. I was talking to a friend of mine, or rather texting, who is a day trader. And I said, listen, how do you know what to do in these war-torn, volatile times as far as investing? I mean, what is safe? You know, commodities are skyrocketing, but is it too late to get in on that? And, you know, do I really believe that silver is overvalued and I go for it? Or, you know, half of the people are saying, don't mess with that. He says, you know what? I would call Rick Rule. Get Rick Rule on the line. He's the guy who can tell you about natural resources, commodities, and how to protect yourself. And so Mr. Rule is the founder over at Global Resource Investments and Sprott Asset Management, devoted his entire life, his career, to looking after securities that are principally natural resources, but other things too, a leading American retail broker in this investment field. They say his contacts and knowledge of the market are unmatched. Mr. Rule, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. So you heard my intro there. I trust that a man who's been doing this for decades has watched a lot of things happen. Wars have come and gone. You know your history. Where do we start? If I'm your daughter and you're advising me in these tough times, what do I do?
If you're my daughter, I probably start by saying that young people's time frames, ironically, are very constrained.
Okay.
When I was a young investor and speculator, I wanted to get results over a long weekend. And the consequence of that was that I seldom allowed my investments to mature enough to make me a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It seems, in my experience at least, that cycles take 4 years, 5 years, or 6 years. And to the extent that investors' expectations correspond with the time frames necessary to achieve success, that they do achieve success. It's ironic, Jackie, at age 69, with fewer five-year periods left in my lifetime, I've become more rather than less patient. So if I was going to start by saying one thing to a daughter, it's that you need to get over letting your expectations govern your actions, and you need to allow that eighth wonder of the world, compounding, to make you money.
Yes. Well, right. So I will make a confession. I'm a very aggressive investor, heavy in U.S. equities and index funds. And for the past 3 or 4 years, it's been great. And yep. I know that all years will not be like these years. So there are some bond holdings now, you know, like the fixed annuities and things like that, that have worked their way into my life. But I'm finding myself kicking myself for not anticipating the current world instability. I mean, I'll betray a bias here. I kind of thought that when the president we have now got elected, things could get unstable. I thoroughly and totally believe that. So why didn't I start buying commodities, knowing that war is inflationary and that things get crazy? Is it too late? Or do you think commodities have a lot of room to run due to crisis in the next 6 months or so?
Well, you made a lot of points there, so let's try to deal with them sequentially.
Jump in wherever you like.
In the first instance, I think that in natural resources and precious metals, we're going to see two bull markets respectively. We're in the early stages. It's very rare that you get corresponding bull markets in natural resources and precious metals. We, of course, well, you didn't. You were too young. But we saw it in the decade of the 1970s in spades. The gold price went from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce. The oil price went from $3 a barrel to $30 a barrel. Truly spectacular time. For different reasons this time, I think that we have two bull markets in store for us, and I think they have a lot farther to run. Let's look at them, if I may, sequentially.
Sure.
Precious metals. Precious metals run primarily because of fear, and not just general fear, but rather fear of the maintenance of purchasing power in savings and investment instruments that are denominated in fiat currencies, even a fiat currency as strong as the U.S. dollar. Are those fears justified? I think so, for three reasons. The first, Jackie, is quantitative easing. If you did it, that is, if you printed specious currency, it would be counterfeiting and you would be put in jail. If, however, you were Congresswoman Daley, it would be policy and you would be popular and be reelected.
Yes.
It's interesting to note arithmetically that in excess of 35% of the U.S. dollars ever in circulation have been printed in the last 30 months.
Yeah.
It is a truism that if you make more of something with no backing, with no value, you depreciate the value of those that were in existence. So people who are concerned about inflation, people who are concerned about the deterioration of purchasing power of U.S. dollar-denominated savings, need first to look at the fact that the government is actively engaged in counterfeiting, except they call it quantitative easing.
Mm-hmm.
The second, particularly from the point of view of a young person like yourself, is more pernicious, which is to say debt and deficits. What debts really are is a transfer of wealth from young productive people like yourself to people like myself who are past their prime. We are consuming today and leaving the bill for that consumption to future generations. And of course, this is concerning. Again, the arithmetic is crazy. The on-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government now exceed $30 trillion. That's 12 zeros after the 30. And more concerning, the off-balance sheet liabilities, which is to say entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the various trust funds, the net present value of those, not the gross value, but rather the net present value, exceeds $125 trillion.
Yeah.
At the federal level, not state and local level, at the federal level, we owe each other $145 trillion. And we propose to pay that debt with a budget that's in deficit by $3 trillion. That's an unsolvable arithmetic problem. The third, however, is even more pernicious, and that's negative real interest rates. The idea, this is the first time in my life that the government has made me a promise they're going to keep. Their promise goes like this. If I lend them money in the U.S. 10-year Treasury for 10 years, they pay me 2.57% today in a currency that's depreciating by their count by 8.5%. In other words, they solemnly swear that if I give them money today, they will give me back less 10 years from now than today. For the first time in my life, they've made a promise they're going to keep, but it's not a good promise. My friend Jim Grant calls negative real interest rates, quote, return-free risk. So if you add up quantitative easing, call it by its real name, counterfeiting, debt and deficits, and negative real interest rates, you end up with three very real reasons why the commodities that have traditionally been regarded as stores of value during times of inflation, which is to say precious metals, should do well. Two more factors I think you need to consider, and I'm sorry for this long-winded answer.
No, please. This is riveting. This is great.
Two more things you have to consider. Precious metals are out of favor and under-owned. It is estimated that the market share of precious metals relative to other savings and investment assets in the United States is less than 0.5%, which is to say less than 0.5% of the total savings and investment assets in the United States are denominated in precious metals. Wow. The 40-year or four-decade median and mean market share is between 1.5% and 2%. So if quantitative easing, debt and deficits, and negative real interest rates work their way into people's consciousness, gold doesn't need to win the war against the U.S. dollar. It needs just to lose it less badly. If it were to revert to mean, which is what I think is going to happen, demand for precious metals and precious metals related assets would increase by a factor of 2 or 3 fold.
Okay.
Finally,
yes.
Traditionally, the biggest investors in the world, the pension funds, the annuities, mm-hmm. the sovereign wealth funds, have followed a portfolio sort of allocation that was 60% equity, 40% debt. And it worked great for 40 years of declining interest rates. As real yields fell, the capital value of the bonds increased, all that kind of stuff. That game's over. We've seen, as an example, the yield on the U.S. 10-year go from 15.5 to 2.5. It's kind of tough to take rates below zero. In other words, pay somebody to take your money. And given that the capital gain around the bond is at least in the last inning as opposed to in the first inning, and given the fact, too, that the yields don't maintain their purchasing power, the largest institutions in the world look at one asset class, which is 40% of their assets, that guarantees that they will be unable to pay the benefits that they're trying to pay to, as an example, their pension funds or future citizens of their countries or to the universities that they're pledged to maintain. As those institutional investors have to diversify out of bonds, with the primary reason for that diversification being a concern about inflation or deterioration of the value of the dollar, it makes sense that some of that money would find its way into an asset class that has historically been a store of value, pardon me, in precisely these times.
Okay. All right. I have to go to break, but I want to pick up on a question that is sort of ancillary to what you're saying, which is, given that most other governments are just as irresponsible as ours, like, why, where the heck do you go for fiat currency, or do you at all? I'll start there when I come back with Rick Rule. He is, as I said earlier, the founder over at Global Resource Investments and Sprott Asset Management USA. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Rick Rule, and he is over at the Global Resource Investments Group. He's the founder, and Sprott Asset Management USA. We were just talking about how precious metals are undervalued and underowned, like big time. And essentially, I'm listening to the fact that, you know, metals are money. They have value in and of themselves in every corner of the earth, no matter what jurisdiction. You know, historically, people have looked to the U.S. dollar as a safe place, or a safe currency to hold, because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S., which isn't much after what we heard last segment. I said to Rick Rule, but you know what? They're all the governments of the world are almost as bad. And if they aren't, they're corrupt and they're cooking their books. I mean, where do you go to find quality fiat currency, or do you, is my question.
Well, that's a great question. There's a joke in my circles that the U.S. dollar is the worst currency in the world, with the sole exception of all of the others.
Right.
Jim Grant once described the dollar as the prettiest mare at the slaughterhouse. And I think if you look at the length and breadth of the U.S. economy, which is to say 23% of GDP, world GDP, and you look at the fact that we are still the most transparent and in many senses the most open and creative economy in the world, that the future for the United States, looking at 15 years, 20 years from now, is probably still very great. The difficulty is that the value proposition that's offered up by the U.S. dollar, while it is arguably better than the value proposition offered up by any other currency in the world, with the possible exception of the Swiss franc, which is too small a currency to matter, the outlook in the United States, despite the fact of the arithmetic that I gave you earlier, is probably more attractive than the alternatives. Years and years ago, probably 2011, sometime like that, I was talking to a portfolio manager of a very large Asian sovereign wealth fund, and they had a lot of U.S. treasuries in their portfolio. And I said to him, you know, I'm delighted with this transaction. You send us all kinds of cool stuff, cars, steel, computers and stuff, and we send you back promises painted on pieces of paper. You know, from my point of view, this is really cool. How do you look at it? And he sort of smiled, you know, and I said, you know, given the interest rate and given the debt obligations of the U.S., it feels to me like this piece of paper that we're sending you is a lie. And he smiled and he said, yes, Mr. Rule, of course, but it is a deep and liquid lie, unlike the lies that other people tell us.
Yeah.
So I think that goes to your question. I think to the extent that you're an American who does business in Australia, you probably have to hold some Australian dollars. But the truth is that for the liquid part of your portfolio, for the part of your portfolio that used to be stable, you need to understand that you're losing purchasing power. Ironically, I have reasonably high cash balances in my portfolio, knowing that I'm losing money on them, but knowing too that if we have a circumstance where there's a crisis in confidence in the economy, if we were, as an example, to have a replay of 2008, if there was some black swan event, that in an illiquid market, were it to occur, having that cash would give me both the tools and the courage to take advantage of volatility rather than being taken advantage of by volatility. Mm-hmm. And in direct answer to your question, most of my liquidity is U.S. dollar denominated, despite my concerns about the currency. I just try to hedge it by owning metals.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right, let me switch gears on you to ESG. It is well known that I am a sworn enemy of ESG investment criteria, and that makes me very unpopular in certain circles. Mostly, I think it's not what it claims to be, and I think that it actually is open to a number of legal challenges, whether it's antitrust violations for banks colluding to divest from an entire segment of the economy, or breach of fiduciary duty by the people who run the companies. Not looking out for returns, or tortious interference with contract, and I have a lot of thoughts. But for our purposes today, can I just hear from you? Do you believe that ESG investment criteria are at least a significant part of the current problem we have at the gas pump with energy prices and also with inflation? Since the price of oil and natural gas and other things are built into the cost of everything?
I mean, the very quick answer is yes, but I think we need to go further than that. I'm a huge fan of ESG investing if I get to decide what ESG is.
Right. Oh, me too.
Let's look at ESG. Environmental, social, and
governance.
Let's look at the social part just for fun, and let's look at energy. 1.2 billion people in the world have no access to electricity at all, Jackie.
Right.
Another 2 billion people have access to unaffordable energy. It is either inconsistent or they can't afford it. All the people who live in those countries, all the people who lack access to energy would like to have it. Whose right is it to deprive them of that? A billion people in the world live in households where the median calorie count is below 1,200 calories a day.
Yeah.
While I'm not one to argue for the health benefits of obesity, obesity is a choice, and most of those people would probably like to increase their calorie counts to 1,600 to 1,800 calories a day. Does Ms. Thornburg have the right to tell those people that they have to be perpetually skinny?
Or starved?
I don't think so.
Or dying?
Right. I don't think so. Let's talk about gender equality. Equality of opportunity, I think, is a very good thing. I think that a substantial amount of the credit for the ascent of humankind in the last 40 years actually has to do with inclusion. I think that allowing, as a big one, a woman to choose what her role is going to be in the economy rather than assigning a role to her is a very good thing. So if you look at equality of opportunity and the changing of attitudes around contribution, I think it's a good thing. Going further than that, I think a lot of the strides that we've made as a society have had to do both with technology, but also the democratization of technology. Where I'm going with that is if you look at U.S. prosperity and you think about the fact that despite all our ills, five or six young pimply-faced people can take over a garage in Sunnyvale and out pops Google. What I think will happen in the future is that Google, that garage, may be in Lagos. It may be in Mumbai. It may be in Jakarta. It doesn't have to be in Sunnyvale anymore. So if you define ESG the way I do, they used to have, ESG used to be called corporate social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
If you defined it as corporate social opportunity, which is to say that you hired the best person for the job, irrespective of whether they had indoor or outdoor plumbing, that's a very good thing. It's a very, very good thing. In our business, the things that we used to do 40 or 50 years ago, environmentally in the mining and oil and gas business, I was there. They were deplorable. And the idea that pollution, which is to say the export of deleterious materials from a mine site, is a tort. It's a property crime, I think would be a very good thing. This idiotic hand-wringing that denies the ascent of humankind, that vilifies an industry that is responsible for the world's material well-being, is stupid.
Yeah.
Mercifully, there are lots of societies in the world that are looking at us and saying, it's amazing that America is so rich that she can afford to be this dumb.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. There's a lot of room for error over here. Now, unfortunately, bad decisions on our part can actually harm people elsewhere. And I've made this argument that policies based on things like ESG criteria, woke policy, strangling the U.S. oil patch so that OPEC and Russia and others can take market share, does things like enable bad actors to wage war. I have argued that it's one reason why Russia can afford a war is because of our suicidal policies here, especially in energy. Do you think that is fair or accurate, or is it an overstatement?
No, I don't think it's an overstatement. I think if you look as an example at Europe's energy dependence on Russia, the Europeans' ability to constrain Russian behavior in the Ukraine is itself constrained by virtue of the fact that without the Russians, they freeze.
Yeah. Yeah.
The idea that Russia and the Ukraine are at war, but Russian natural gas flows through the Ukraine and is bought by France and Hungary, who both pay the Russians for the gas, but also pay the Ukrainians to transport it, tell you really all you need to know about your statement. And well, the big thinkers, I mean, I don't need to talk to you too much about the big thinkers, but the idea that they took 400 or 500 private jets, to Davos to tell you and I to drive less.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But the whole state, the whole system though, is all about, as long as you can pay for the carbon offsets, you can just emit as much carbon as you want. Let's admit this is a system for the privileged. It's a faith for the privileged, and it sure doesn't help, as you said, the third world or the developing world, or even Americans who are simply middle class. This sacrifices, right, that we're expected to make in lifestyle.
And Jackie, it's very easy to figure out how cynical they are, because when they put in place taxes and fees against carbon, they're not revenue neutral. If this was about carbon, they would use the revenue from a carbon tax to lower tax somewhere else in the feeding chain. This isn't about carbon. This is about narrative, and this is about increasing the size of government control over your lives and over the economy.
Okay.
It's extremely cynical.
Let me ask you a more refined question, and one that is not fair because you can't possibly know the answer, but I want your guess. Are the people who are in the green movement, and I have like 30 seconds, who are in the movement, who meet at Davos or at the World Economic Forum or the UN, what percentage of the people there are truly the narrative cynical people that we know, and how many are true believers? Like, they're sincere.
You know, I've never been invited to Davos. I'm sure that doesn't surprise you. And so I can't say that based on firsthand information. I can tell you that I consider myself to be an environmentalist.
Me too.
I live on Puget Sound. I'm surrounded by a beautiful forest. Now, admittedly, I'm privileged. And I belong to several environmental organizations. I don't belong to any environmental organizations that lobby. I don't believe that I have the right to impose my will on other people politically. I believe in things like the Nature Conservancy, where I use my money and the money of like-minded people to buy and preserve land. In that sense, I'm an environmentalist.
Okay. All right. I'm talking to Rick Rule, and he is the founder over at Global Resource Investments and Sprott Asset Management USA. Rick, this has been great. I could ask you 1,000 more questions, but I know you're a busy man. I'm just grateful that you were generous with your time and learned from you today and have a lot of nice takeaways. I mean, anyone listening today, I think, has learned from you and is maybe reassured, actually. You actually think there's a future for the U.S. dollar. So that was a ray of promise and hope and otherwise a bad news cycle. Rick, thanks so much.
Jackie, thank you very much for the opportunity. I enjoyed the process.
Likewise. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Find me online at jackiedaly.com, on Facebook, and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Host. Okay, if there's one thing that oil and gas is missing, the whole world of energy, it's sexiness and art and creativity. There are very few people with a creative flair who are out there singing the praises of the oil and gas industry or the people in it. And that's too bad. That's too bad, because I spend my days here telling you all the good news, all the great things about the U.S. oil patch that you otherwise wouldn't hear. There is a young lady named Alma, A-L-M-A, Alma, who you can find at HearAlma.com, HearAlma.com. She is a singer. She is a songwriter. She went from the big city to the oil patch up in the Bakken, North Dakota, Williston, and made a career there, actually, in safety compliance with a company there. And she has a brand new song, a single called 5,000 Candles, 5,000 Candles, that actually celebrates the people of the Bakken oil field. And she's here on the line. Alma, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Jackie. It's a delight to be here. And you're sure right that there aren't too many people working on this messaging problem that our industry has, especially from an artistic standpoint. So thank you.
Yeah, I know. And it's key. There are some things that can penetrate the culture, right? Humor and art, yeah, and music. And that is something that people who are very nuts and bolts, like the oil and gas people, they're just not focused on it. Their job is to make things, right?
Their job is to extract this natural resource from miles under the surface and battle Mother Nature doing it and make the world go around. They don't have the time or the interest in writing songs or working on the messaging problem. So, yeah it's...
Okay, so but you were inspired to write this song, you said, when flying over the Bakken oil field, and there's a very special and unique view. Or I will say that about the Permian, because I fly out to West Texas once in a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from the sky, it kind of looks like a bunch of little, in the daytime, little baseball fields, you know, from a distance. And you're like, whoa. And that is actually all of those different entry points into the Earth's surface to get that mm-hmm. resource out. And it's really a sight to behold if you've never seen it. But in the Bakken, at night, what do you see?
Well, something very similar, Jackie. It's funny that you say it looks kind of like baseball fields. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're so correct. All those little pads.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're oddly shaped. But yeah, so I just some backstory about me. Like you said, I'm a city kid through and through, and not only was a city kid, but I was a music major. So about the farthest thing from this industry that you can imagine. But I, you know, after college, I was living in LA doing my musician thing. I took some odd jobs at my friend's company up here in Williston doing some safety compliance stuff. And I always tell people I didn't know the difference between a drilling rig and a cell phone tower back in those days. So when I flew into Williston at night, I certainly didn't know that I was looking at thousands of natural gas flares that looked like candlesticks. I didn't know if it was a good thing. I didn't know if it was intentional. I didn't know if it was dangerous. I just knew that, you know, they're kind of pretty, and this is the kind of thing that you write songs about. So when I saw it, you know, on my first trip up, I went back to my hotel room, started writing a piece about it. And now years later, with a lot more context for what's going on in this industry, since I'm a business owner myself now, I am bringing this music video forward to really showcase the dignity and the glory of this underappreciated industry.
So to be clear, the 5,000 candles is a reference to 5,000 flares, like flames.
That's correct. And we've, yeah. Exactly. We have a lot fewer than 5,000 these days. I think we've gotten our flaring down by like 95% or something. It's a wonderful thing to know we're reducing it. But, you know, for somebody who's a total newcomer, you just kind of, there's a magic to it. You know, you don't really understand the meaning and you don't understand the problem that these flares can pose. So it's certainly something to celebrate that we're getting past it now. But yep, I sure saw a lot of natural gas flares on that flight.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, environmentalists complain about these flares because they emit, you know, we are causing emissions. Okay. It should be noted that this is the burning of resource. People would probably mm-hmm. prefer to sell all that resource rather than burn it into the sky. But oftentimes they don't have the pipelines. They don't have the infrastructure. They don't have, for some reason or another, they can't move it to yeah. market, right? So this is kind of like, in a sense, it bothers me because it's waste. I'd rather we be using it. But the realities on the ground was that this is what they did because they had to. They had to do yeah. something. And so, yeah, as you're
yeah,
saying,
and
go ahead.
It's so funny, Jackie, as you were talking, I'm like, oh, this is the problem. I mean, in order to be anti-flare, you have to be pro-pipeline. But you don't yeah. see too much of that on the environmentalist side. So, yeah, it'll be great points.
Exactly. So the pipeline is the environmentally friendly solution. But, of course, they're full-throated, you know, opposition against it. So back to the song. I saw the video. It was very well done, very beautifully done. And you're a pretty girl. And of course, you feature prominently in the video, which was smart on your part. But you also see a lot of normal, everyday people up in Williston. And like, this is just this almost forgotten state up there where we have apparently more millionaires per capita than any other state in the union. Little known fact about North Dakota. That was, of course, post fracking boom, not before. Mm-hmm. And so, I've only got like 1 minute left. What was your primary goal in making this video?
Well, my primary goal with the video was to show that the beautiful thing about Williston is not that scene of natural gas flares at night that, like you said, all of us would like to mitigate. It's really the people that make it a glorious and dignified and wonderful place. So I did showcase a lot of my own clients in this video, those everyday people. Some of them are pretty on their own as well. They've got quite a number of beards, you'll see. But it's a uniquely North Dakota kind of pretty. aesthetic. I really wanted to show America, hey, like, these are people you use as a political football, but they're actual human beings. And I want to introduce you to the real human beings making the world as you know it possible. That was my goal with 5,000 Kendalls.
Yes. Okay, so now you sing the song, right? And you wrote the song.
I did.
Now, do you also play music, instruments?
I do. I am. I'm on the track just a little bit, but you probably wouldn't be able to hear me. I'm playing ukulele behind the guitar.
So okay.
you can't quite hear it, but I play just enough, you know, just enough tenor guitar, ukulele, piano to write songs and be dangerous. But I tend to leave the instrumentalist. The real work to the instrumentalists in that department, you know, got to hire everybody in their proper lane the same way you would out here in the oil and gas play.
Yes.
That's my philosophy.
No, that's for sure. Okay, so people can find your song 5,000 Kendalls on Spotify, Apple Music, SoundCloud, and they can find you at HearAlma.com. That's H-E-A-R, HearAlma.com. So with that, we will now play 5,000 Kendalls.
There's a lot of people running their mouth that don't stay the night, never come through town. And some other people running about that don't take the time to suss you out. Still some of us every night be making toast to you, like isn't it nice that somebody had the presence of mind to speak up for you. Let there be light. Up in the play, we don't think enough about the beauty we make. It's all work here every day, but when the lights go out, it's then that I say, sad to behold, nothing you could do will make me go. We'll let the world judge what they don't know, giving me a heartbeat, making me never wanna leave. We'll let the world judge, cause they don't see. 5,000 candles, 5,000 candles. Loving you the way that I do, because you could love somebody like you. They say you're too damn small, and I won't pretend it don't matter at all. But no matter what the trouble ahead, I still won't regret this time that I spent. Sad to behold, nothing you could do would make me go. We'll let the world judge what they don't know, giving me a heartbeat, making me never want to leave.
You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online, jackiedaily.com. All right, I am going to now share with you commentary on a book that advocates eco-terrorism. Yes, Eco-terrorism. I am not going to tell you the name of this book because I don't want anyone to buy it. But I saw it advertised and I thought, that sure sounds like a book on how to commit eco-terrorism. What is eco-terrorism? It is the work of rabid, deranged, psychotic people who believe themselves to be environmentalists and green, doing things like using explosives to blow up things, like pipelines, houses, plants, God knows what. So it's an excuse for really horrific behavior. You hear about it every now and then. I bet we don't hear about most of it because the companies involved do not want you to know their weaknesses, where they're vulnerable. They don't want copycats. They don't want people to be inspired, you know. So I think it's actually not at all uncommon. But in any event, I get this book. And as you might imagine, there's this really brazen emotional tear against fossil fuels and how they harm the planet. And it's a lot of recycled talking points, except much more catastrophic stuff and apocalyptic visions woven in than you're used to. This person clearly is fixated. And as you go through, guess what I found? Not one word devoted to the catastrophic consequences of a world where this person gets their way. And we end the use of fossil fuels and nuclear energy. That is 80% or more of the world's energy, depending on where you are. And I'm not just talking about electricity. I'm talking about transportation fuel and petrochemicals. If you actually gave this lunatic his way, billions of people would starve. Like, fast. Super fast. This wouldn't take 2 years, 3 years. If you don't have petrochemicals to make fertilizer to quadruple the crop yield as we do today, billions of people starve. If you don't have fossil fuels to transport in vehicles made of oil mostly and manufactured with fossil fuels, if you can't transport the food to the people who need it around the world, they starve. If you don't have pharmaceuticals, which is made from petrochemicals, this is oil and gas derived chemicals, people die. I mean, this is simple. You don't have modern sanitation. You don't have hospitals. I mean, unless you want something out of the like Crusader era. It's absurd. Not one word to the apocalyptic hell that would be ushered in if this terrorist actually got his way. No, he's all righteous. He is all righteous. Here's the deal. He claims that he is fed up with the environmental movement. He has lost his patience, okay? His claim, and maybe it's true, is that the majority of the green movement is nonviolent and believes that if they ever turn violent, it would actually be counterproductive, right? People would turn against them. If you start blowing up people's homes and stuff, they won't like you. That's probably true. He says that's not right and that they're looking at the wrong thing. And so apparently before you go on these climate marches and protests, you have to sign a document saying that you will not destroy property, you will not hurt people, blah, 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 blah. Okay? You know what I see? What I see there is CYA, cover your tail, organizers. Dude, they're not even serious. Please, all they want to do is point to the piece of paper and say, well, we told everybody to not be violent. And then we showed him this book, and the book says, so he gets to this book, and he's like, you're circulating this book among the green leadership. And apparently what it does is it looks back at successful protest movements and attempts to prove that only the nonviolent movements have succeeded, at least in the past 100 years or 150. And so it goes through, you know, the suffragettes who fought for women's right to vote, or the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. And it points to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and sit-ins and songs and writers and the exercise of First Amendment rights, basically, to achieve change. Okay. And then it looks at apartheid. So Nelson Mandela and Gandhi, and how he worked to de-Britainize India, when clearly the Brits had the upper hand historically, militarily, whatever. Okay, so this terrorist, or at least he's a man, I'm not going to call him a terrorist, okay, he's a man who advocates for terrorism, at a minimum, extreme property damage. Yes, that's terrorism. He's saying, you know what? All of that history is wrong. All of it is wrong. And the reason I read the book, he finally gives it to you right here. I'm trying to figure out how did perfectly civilized, sane, professional people in this country, at our universities and elsewhere, turn into this violence advocating cabal, which resulted in the riots of 2020. You know, a lot of very sophisticated people with letters after their names, like PhD, endorsed that behavior. They're like, oh no, violence is sometimes justified. I'm like, well, when did this start? Well, this dude gives me the answer. He goes through and gives his counter history to the history. He attempts to rewrite the history. He says, the truth is that of all those movements that the green activists cite to, all of them were in fact violent. And he pulls out examples like, okay, in the UK in the early 1900s, the women's suffrage activists were knocking windows out of buildings. And at one time they set this place on fire. And at another time, this other one over here says something else on fire. And he goes through and tries to, like, quantify every act of violence committed in support of what was an otherwise overall nonviolent movement that succeeded. And he also argues that the only reason that the civil rights movement actually worked was not because of Dr. King. It was because of Malcolm X. And that if we didn't have Malcolm X out there agitating and threatening violence in support of what Dr. King was doing, there never would have been a successful civil rights movement. So that is essentially what is in the book. It argues that violence solves problems. Violence solves problems. Okay, so now you know. There, I have to confess, I completely missed out on the revisionist history that says that, in fact, you know, the women who fought for the right to vote in this country and in the UK cowed everyone into submission with physical violence. You know? We're supposed to believe that our... that our grandfathers, our great-grandfathers, were terrified and gave women the right to vote only because they threatened physical violence against the men of the day. All right? That's what happened. How this terrorism advocate can explain the fact that the people who he claims won by violence were in every instance brazenly outgunned by the other side? He doesn't explain that. He doesn't. Maybe, look, violence can solve problems, but it's more like, remember what President Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. I mean, that was Trumpian before there was Trump, right? It's a great expression, speak softly and carry a big stick. That was U.S. foreign policy for a long time. I think until the lead from behind mantra replaced it. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.